Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. This Saturday, Andrea's will host local author Craig Swanson. He'll be signing copies of his book, The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the defining struggle of the Civil Rights Era. That's this Saturday from noon to 2 at Andrea's. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. A very exciting event is happening at the University of Wisconsin Parkside on Tuesday evening, the 17th of February, with the screening of an absolutely beautiful and riveting documentary film called Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee. Ruby Dee, of course, was an extraordinarily gifted human being, a wonderful actress and poet and playwright and writer, and an activist with her equally gifted husband, and so we are. There are so many reasons to follow the careful career, fascinatingly diverse career of Ruby Dee, with great interest. And this film does an absolutely stunning job of bringing this wonderful, vibrant woman thrillingly to life, and not only her life, but that of her husband, Ossie Davis. The film is the loving work of Mutalib Muhammad, who was is a grandson of Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, and he himself a cinematographer and an actor and a budding activist as well. And this film is remarkable not only for the way in which it highlights the wonderful life of Ruby Dee and her husband, but also underscores the sort of life's journey that Mutalib Muhammad himself has gone on in trying to sort out his place in the world, and particularly the role in which he feels maybe he is called to play in this turbulent world. And so his own life's journey is very much a part of this remarkable film. Again, on Tuesday evening, February 17th, you have the opportunity to see it and to meet Mutalib Muhammad, who will be here for this event. Mutalib Muhammad, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to come out to Kenosha, and it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I am also really glad you allowed me access to a link that allowed me to watch the film, and I very, very, very much enjoyed it. Tell us, first of all, where you grew up and what kind of a presence your famous grandmother and grandfather had in your life.
I grew up in Westchester County in New York. When I was very, very young, it was in Mount Vernon. And then when I got a little bit older, I think 6 or 7, it was in New Rochelle. And Grandpa and Grandma Ruby, they lived in New Rochelle from 1963 up until Grandma Ruby passing in 2014. So all I knew was going to Grandpa and Grandma Ruby's house for the weekend, for all the holidays, and to hang out. And that was a place where the whole family gathered, their 3 children and 7 grandchildren and the cousins and everything. So growing up in that close proximity to them, and I also had my other grandparents in New Rochelle also, it was a very warm atmosphere and a wholesome atmosphere, and we learned a lot without even knowing we were learning. It was a great experience, though.
At what point did it start to really dawn on you, or did you really understand just how famous your grandfather and grandmother were?
You know, I think I was much older. I think I was in my 20s. Because I don't know how I have a knack for taking things for granted until it's too late. And I didn't think it was not until I fully left the nest that I understood to such the extreme degree that they've had success in a range of areas in their lives. And, you know, once I started to face my own difficulties, especially when it came to three areas of my life, when it came to love, when it came to my artistic career, and when it came to my civic participation. I felt a little lost. I felt disconnected. I felt unable to do what I kind of learned from them to do. So that kind of spilled into this piece here, because I wanted to seize the opportunity I had to speak with my grandmother, and somehow having it on camera allowed me as the grandson the opportunity to dive deeper into subjects that I might be too shy to bring up if it weren't for the purposes of a story. And it was very fulfilling to do so, and the audience gets to share that experience with me, because there are people who wrote Grand Ruby letters and came over for advice and all this stuff, and I'm her grandson, and it was like, you know what, I'd be so crazy not to sit here and let her wisdom be captured on film and share it. So that's part of why we did the whole story, Life's Essentials with Ruby D.
And it probably says a lot about your grandmother and your grandfather that you could go for such a long time and not even realize just how famous they were. I mean, it probably says something about the way that they lived their lives, that in the midst of their family, that was paramount to who they were and what they had achieved in their professional lives. I mean, it really says a lot about them. They didn't expect to be treated like stars and didn't probably want to be seen like that within the bosom of this very loving family in which you grew up.
No, I mean, they really emphasized education and the value of family. And those things above so many other things, their careers were not on the list of things that they emphasized. It actually took my Aunt Nora a lot to convince them to do their autobiography, but of course everyone loved that, and the audio version of that won the Grammy because people are excited to hear their story, but their story's never been told on film. And you can tell from how she speaks with me where her priorities lie. And whenever I speak with Gram Ruby or spoke with Gram Ruby about life, she had the perspective of helping others ahead of helping herself. And her art fell underneath that principle, and her activism fell underneath that principle of helping other people. So I definitely enjoyed this experience, and I'm happy to be sharing it with everyone too.
I'm just curious also, as you were growing up, was filmmaking, acting, theater, the arts, were those an important part of your life, even as a young man in, let's say, middle school and high school? Or was that a time where you were taken up with other things and did, in a sense, these artistic possibilities for your life only enter the picture later?
Well, I wanted to be an inventor when I was a little kid. And I was always around art. There's so many artists in my family. My mother's a writer. My uncle Guy is a bluesman, and my father plays guitar. And Grandpa and Grandma Ruby, so many artists. And I realized us as in our human nature, we want to create things, and be it through baking a cake or wanting to invent something in an engineering lab or to create a movie. And being around Grandpa and Grandma Ruby, and that creative expression, isn't that magic when they would just tell a simple story around the table? And watching that magic was really inspiring and really gave me the confidence to give it a shot. So that definitely had a serious influence on me. And I did start diving deeper into things. I remember Grandpa sitting with me and going through my first screenplay, writing notes in it. And like, he was such a genius writer, too. And you'll see, or you saw in the picture, he did Pearly Victorious, and he was a genius writer. So just to be around that energy and that excitement when they come across even someone else's work of art that was precious to them, like Zora Neale Hurston, Grandma Ruby loved her work so much, it inspired the heck out of me. So definitely.
We're speaking with Muttalie Muhammad, grandson of Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, and he is director of a beautiful documentary called Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee, which is being screened at the University of Wisconsin Parkside on Tuesday evening, February 17th. Your beloved grandfather died in 2005, and we get the definite sense from this film that his death was at least in part the catalyst which drove you to get this film made, although maybe you can tell us if even ahead of that you were already thinking along these lines. But I remember at some point in the voiceover you say, Grandpa's death is what taught me to speak now, to value now, because that's all we've got for sure. I'm sure his death certainly had to have heightened your sense of urgency to really sit down with your grandmother and make a film like this.
You're absolutely right. Even just speaking about it is making me emotional right now. That was a tremendous pain that the family went through and that Grandmother went through. And that pain resonated and from it grew that desire to make sure I didn't make the same mistake with Grand Ruby. And I don't want to say take her for granted, but sometimes we don't really respect all that our elders come with, no matter who they are and what they've done. And I would never make that mistake again because of feeling what it feels like to have one of them snatched away, something that was so precious to the world, you know? So his death affected a whole lot of people, as you can see in the footage, those thousands of people, but definitely the family. It affected us a lot. And as I did this process, it wasn't just me championing it. The whole family was behind it, Aunt Nora's the executive producer, and the whole community who knew that their story needed to be told on a large platform. And by the community, I mean the 394 Kickstarter supporters that we have. I mean, our sponsors now, I mean, every person who we approached really, really loved what Grandpa and Grand Ruby did. And I was really happy to be able to create this work of art.
How did your grandmother, Grandma Ruby, greet this possibility? I mean, there's a really precious little moment. I think it's as you are about to begin one of your first actual on-camera interviews with her, and she confesses to being kind of nervous about it. I wonder if you could just speak more about that and about whether or not she was at all reluctant in any way whatsoever or kind of curious about what this sort of film might actually sort of look like. Or was she an eager and willing participant right from the start?
No, not from the start. It was an interesting story. I approached her initially to do sort of an arm's length standard traditional documentary, and she wasn't really excited about it. People approached her about doing documentaries all the time, and it took a lot of convincing to get her not only to just tell a story about her, but she also had to overcome that hurdle of having to tell a story that relates to her late husband, and wanted to make sure that she does that well, and that I do that well. But when we came to her with the concept that Life Essentials is all about, where a grandchild can learn from their elder, and she saw how much anyone looking over my shoulder could learn through watching this piece, not only about the chronology and the facts in her life, but just about what she and Grandpa stood for, then she really sunk her teeth into it, and she put her 2 cents into the synopsis, and she got excited about it. And by the time we started filming, she was still Grand Ruby. That's what we call her, Grand Ruby. And I say that to say that the first interview I had, my producing partner, NJ Frank, he was with me in our first interview. We hit roll, and I'm interviewing my grandmother. At least I tried to. And she stops the cameras and everything and lectures me on everything from my posture to how I should enunciate. And it was terrifying. But I learned real quickly, and I didn't get embarrassed too much. And eventually she got into it. And that's the same interview when she said she was nervous. And once we got about a month into the project, she got so excited. She couldn't wait till it was done. And it took about 2 years to get done. But she was on board 100%. And she told me herself what this story was about before I even realized it. And it's Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee. So it's about Ruby Dee, and it's about her values. And she's like, no, this story is about community. And I said, why? Like, how is it about community? And she said, well, when people watch this, of course, you know, they'll be inspired by certain things about their lives. But when people watch this, she said, they'll be inspired to connect with their loved ones, and you'll strengthen the bonds within the families, and you'll strengthen the bonds within the families on the block and then the whole community and so on. And I said, I didn't agree with her at first, but obviously that's what's happening, because every screening that we have, people at the end in the Q&A session that we'll have in Kenosha, they're asking, you know, how can I do this? This is inspiring. This is moving. I'm glad that you did this, you know. And so she called it. She knew what Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee was all about.
You say at one point, there are more essential things than dates and chronology. I think at that point in the film, you're kind of talking about the fact that that this film is indeed not just a straightforward documentary that charts her life from its beginning to its end in kind of predictable fashion. Did you find yourself kind of wrestling very much with that whole matter of what this film should look like or what how it should be shaped? Even when you knew what it was going to be about, still there's the matter of actually shaping it and crafting it. How easily or how difficultly did this actually come together?
It was very difficult. It was extremely difficult. It took, I was in the edit room for over 500 days, just in the basement editing this thing. And it abides by certain story archetypes and certain structural rules that a drama has to have, but it tells the story of their lives in three different chapters, one chapter of love, then one chapter of art, and one chapter of activism. And within each of those chapters, the content is unveiled in a chronological way, but the dates aren't stressed, you know, because I want people to focus on their moral decisions. And all of that was very difficult to do, especially on top of that, for it to be narrated to her in an open letter format. But the audience, when they receive it, it all seems to congeal and work together. And I really am happy about that. But it took a great deal of thought. And it took a risk, too, because I was afraid to make myself a piece of the story. But that hinge allows my generation, as we've seen it now in our screening, to have a role, an active role in the piece, and see how the issues that they face, some of them mirror my issues, see what Ruby Dee and or Ossie Davis would say about them. And I think that's a safe way that people go to watch something. It's a safe way to see that and maybe make a self-criticizing thought, being self-critical without even having to take the risk. I think that's a good opportunity for people to learn.
Hmm. How difficult was it to speak with your grandmother about her husband's death, of course, which in the moment was incredibly painful and, of course, to some extent has to be painful to this very day. What was it like to tread those kind of very emotional waters with her?
It was very difficult. We shot about 7 interviews with her, and I saved asking her about Grandpa's death till as late as I could because I just felt it was wrong of me to make my grandmother recall something so painful. And even when I did it, I just felt bad about it. But she's the toughest person in our whole family. So she handled it very well. And I'm glad that I was able to ask her about it because I never asked her about it in person off camera just for that same reason, like, why do that? But I think that it's worth it when she can preserve her thoughts on it because it helps so many of us who might have to face a loss like that. And I think she understood that when she answered the question.
One of the intriguing visual tools that you use, or a visual gesture, I'm not sure exactly the way we should describe this, but at many points during the film, we suddenly see what appears to be some kind of lens pass across the screen, almost like someone is taking a monocle, one of those single lenses that one might hold up to your eye to see something clearer, and it's as though a monocle is kind of passed across the screen, which both clarifies and to some extent also momentarily kind of distorts the image that we're actually seeing. But I really loved that, even though I didn't know precisely what you had in mind there. But it's a wonderful kind of visual motif that ties the film together. Could you just say a word about what you had in mind with that little little gesture?
Okay. Well, it was a technical workaround. There were so many photos that we wanted to work with, and my first thought was to use motion graphics and have scan the photos and have them animate on the screen. But I showed it to somebody in TV, and they say, this looks like TV, and I didn't want it to look like TV. And they had this very, very authoritative opinion about it. This, it doesn't look like cinema. It doesn't look like cinema. So I felt a little bit discouraged, and I had to work out, okay, how do I make these photos move and not make it look like television? So I wanted to use a loop, you know, the little magnifier that you look through negatives with, and I didn't have one, but living at Grand Ruby's house during this process, she always would read the newspaper with her magnifying glass. So I said, hey, maybe I can shine the camera through this magnifying glass and get control over the what the viewer sees in a particular photograph. And I tried it, and it worked well. And because it's her magnifying glass and because the whole process is looking deeper into things, I think it fits symbolically, but it really was born out of a technical little glitch that I was facing.
Well, I'm so struck to hear that, because actually we would never guess that. And that what a brilliant solution to kind of a difficult little problem. It's very, very intriguing to think about and to see for ourselves the parade of luminaries who are also part of this film, who offer very heartfelt recollections and reflections on who your grandparents were, and, of course, especially your grandmother, Ruby Dee, a long list of important people in the world of entertainment. First of all, it had to be quite exciting, I should think, and maybe a little intimidating, too, to be approaching some of these people in the hopes that they would be willing to be part of your film. Just say a word about that. I think it's a very important contributing factor to this film's ultimate greatness.
Oh, yeah. Grandpa and Grandma Ruby were loved by so many people, and some of the people who love them are hugely famous, like Alan Alda, Angela Bassett, Harry Belafonte, and they all played a role in the documentary. They all did us a favor and gave us a date and said, come on, and they spoke about Grandpa and Grand Ruby, and from Danny Glover to Hill Harper to Sam Jackson, Spike Lee, Essie Payton Murkerson, Felicia Rashad, Glenn Turman, and other activists like Cornel West and Sonia Sanchez. So we were blessed to have them on camera. It was very intimidated to, not because they were well known, but because they have such a high regard for Grandpa and Grand Ruby. So when I walk in the room, I want to make sure I don't embarrass Grandpa and Grand Ruby. So I needed to make sure that I had all of my, I was prepped to a T, and that I had knew all of my information so that I could stand my ground in a one-on-one interview with these giants. So Mr. Belafonte, that interview was, he granted us an interview for a full hour and a half and talked so much about history and Grandpa and Grand Ruby and meeting them at the American Negro Theater in Harlem. And these friends of Grandpa and Grand Ruby were really a strong piece of why this documentary even was able to be made.
Let's finish with something that I don't think we've yet very much even touched upon, and it is also such an important element of this film, namely that it is not just about your grandmother, Ruby Dee, and her extraordinary husband, Ozzie Davis. This film is also about you, probably to a greater extent than the typical viewer might expect. I mean, to a surprising extent, this film is also about you and about your own struggles to kind of understand your place in the world and the way in which you maybe have felt like you have not quite measured up to some of these life principles and life essentials laid out so forcefully by your grandmother. Just say a word about the kind of personal journey that you have been on and what it feels like to share that so openly with the public in this film.
Well, that was done. I was very open, and I got as honest as I could. And what I did was find that as honest, the more honest I became, the more I understood that the issues I faced sort of served as a metaphor for a lot of issues in the Black community that is generations younger than Grandpa and Grand Ruby. So I made a decision to share in the narrative the weaknesses that I knew Grandpa and Grand Ruby's lives could fix and their values could fix. And while sharing these things with Grand Ruby, her wisdom was able to serve as the contrasting narrative, and that provided the conflict in the story. And I'm happy that I was able to be so honest, and I'm happy that a lot of some of the younger marginalized, mostly people of color who watch the film can understand the frustration that I have when it comes to activism that comes from that honesty about what activism is today versus what it was in Grand Ruby and Grandpa's time. And they thank me for expressing my honesty when it comes to making artistic choices, because it's very tough to even make a living. So to turn down roles that didn't do well, didn't represent black people well, paying roles, to turn those roles down would be very difficult for somebody today. And to listen to Grand Ruby on tape turn down roles that were paying, and this is 50 years ago, is tremendously inspiring, not only to me as the person on the film sharing his weakness, but anyone who can identify with that weakness. So it was for the purpose of really, really showing why people love Ossie and Ruby. Their principles is why people love them. And I know that from walking with them and having everyone stop them. We couldn't walk 10 feet without people stopping and telling Grandpa and Ruby something about them that they loved. And it's usually something good that they did for the people. And I didn't want anybody to be able to go and watch this film and get all the warm and fuzzies about learning more about Ossie Davis and Ruby D and not questioning themselves about how much they live by the principles they admire. And it was an artistic move, and it was a very aggressive move on my part, but it's paying off. And I think that when people receive it the way they do, NJ, the producer, and I definitely made the right decision to tell the story that way.
By the way, we should mention that the film is includes a generous helping of fascinating footage, including not only excerpts from some of the various films in which they starred, and various stage productions, behind the scenes rehearsal footage, and so on. There's also a couple of very interesting points at which we are hearing your grandmother's voice as we watch a cassette tape spin. what was that? What was the occasion on which those comments were recorded? Actually, those end up contributing some of the most interesting moments in the film, I think.
Oh, yeah. The opportunity to really, I didn't even say this, the family archive, I have carte blanche to it. So a lot of the material that you see in the documentary has never been released and is very rich. So some of it is audio material of it's pieces of Grandpa and Grandma. We're just sitting down and brainstorming together. And we use snippets of it, and other parts are snippets from their dual autobiography, which allows them within each chapter to tell their life story in their own words. And that access is one thing that comes with being a relative to the star of the film, and the audience really, really gets an opportunity to soak that up. The rich video we have, the old film that we have. Grand Ruby, she looks so young in the footage we have of her and Harry Belafonte in Harlem, and the audience really gets a kick out of it. Mm.
It is a remarkable film. When was it finished?
It was finished the night she passed away. We were doing the audio mix.
Oh.
So June 2014.
Wow.
So we didn't finish it in time for her to watch the whole thing, but she got to watch Act One as a birthday gift for her in 2012.
Hmm. And of course, through the course of the film, your grandmother is not in robust health, although she's obviously a very determined woman, and fights back through more than one very serious setback. Nevertheless, her death was not in a sense unexpected. I'm sure it was a terrible blow all the same, but what a marvelous tribute this is to her and to all that she stood for. So remind our listeners, for this screening coming up at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, you will be there to do what? What role will you play that night?
Okay, I moved to Ali. I will be there, and my producing partner, NJ Frank, will be there. We will introduce the film, and after the film, we'll have a question and answer period, and I'll take questions from the audience as well as from a moderator, and stay afterwards to hang out.
Very good. Mutala Muhammad, I want to congratulate you again on a marvelous film. Again, Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee, being screened at the University of Wisconsin Parkside Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Very best wishes, and thank you for making time for this interview.
Thank you.
And now I am really delighted to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Sidney Mahone, who is very closely linked to the names of Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, as the editor of the marvelous book which they wrote called In This Life Together, and with Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together. And at the outset of that book, in the acknowledgments, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis say this: "The task, that is, of writing this book would have been impossible without our editor, Sidney Mahone, who worked with us so faithfully and diligently. She helped us immeasurably with the organization of all the materials as fast as we could get it to her, no matter what the order. We appreciate her patience, her sound judgment, and her ability to blend, balance, and intertwine our separate and collective accounts. To pack two lives into one book is a formidable accomplishment indeed." Again, warm words of praise and gratitude to my guest in this portion of the morning show, Sidney Mahone. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You have done a great deal of writing and editing and so on. I should think, however, this moment in your career is one that you regard with very special fondness. Tell us, as best you recall, your very first actual personal encounter with Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. Was it as part of this project?
No, actually, I met them as a dramaturg at Crossroads Theater Company in New Jersey. They were there to work on several of their plays, and I was focused on new play development, so I had the great privilege of working with them very closely to develop some new plays and to see their work ethic and their artistic genius on display in the moment, and they were just fantastic storytellers, so I was really enriched by the opportunity to witness them at work.
Mm.
We worked on three plays. One was an adaptation of a novel that Ruby selected called The Disappearance by Rosa Gee. Another was Two Ha-Has and a Homeboy that involved Ossie, their son Guy, who's a musician, and Ruby. And also an adaptation of Ruby Dee's own collection of writings called My One Good Nerve, which was a one-woman show. So those were the three main events. But the opportunity to work on the book was just the highlight of my career, even to this day.
Right. Maybe you could just take us inside that process a little bit. What were kind of the nuts and bolts by which that book ultimately took shape? The way they phrased their acknowledgement of your work also gives us a sense that it was not the simplest of projects, and we can probably kind of imagine why, but you, as being on the inside, know that better than anybody, probably know that even better than they do, just what a complex project this was, which, of course, ultimately resulted in such a rich book. Tell us about it.
The most challenging and exciting aspect of the process involved figuring out how to balance their voices as writers. As I said, they are fantastic storytellers, so either of them can get on a roll, and they each could have carried the book themselves, right? But I think there were points where there were different perspectives on a particular event, say, so how to accommodate both views. But I guess the fun most satisfying part of it was finding the structure that would work. So the book opens with them each having their own chapters that before they met, and they speak in their own voices in a kind of monologue mode or just a simple narrative. But when we get to the point at which they do meet and marry, then the chapters are shared. And it's a unique format, but I think it worked well. And then at the end of the book, there are more conversational passages that were transcribed for the most part.
What would be some of the most important decisions and choices that you had to make as the editor in shaping all of this into a cohesive and ultimately compelling book? And were any of those choices exceptionally difficult?
The biggest challenge for me was having to cut, you know, and cut some material that I thought was just so wonderful, because of course I too am a fan, and I never overcame that sense of being in awe of them, even as I spent many hours with them and came to be embraced as, you know, one of the team, if you will. But I think the hardest thing was to, I'm going to go back to this thing about balance, because there's a way in which, I guess it's about style, really. Ossie's style is very commanding and authoritative in a way that is very familiar to an average reader. And Ruby's approach is much more poetic and metaphorical and lyrical, if you will. And I didn't want to give the impression that one thread of the narrative was more important or more truthful than the other. And so finding a way for both voices to coexist, to really capture the conversation of their love, their work together, and their perspectives on the world. It really was about the literary voice and making sure that there was space for both kinds of thought and both modes of expression, you know, to stand on equal footing.
Very well put.
for of those course, you, they mm-hmm. shared this commitment to struggle, if you will. That's a lot of what they talk about, the various kinds of struggles that they experienced in building their lives. And I think that aspect of the work really revealed just how brilliant and extraordinarily intelligent they are, or were, and how well prepared they were in terms of their education and their upbringing in families that really depended on cohesive family units, and then extending that to the community and understanding that each one has a role to play, and understanding the importance of you listening for your call to join the struggle, finding your way into the efforts to create a more just and humane world.
We're speaking with Sydney Mahone, and she, among many accomplishments in her career as a writer and editor, was privileged to edit the dual memoir with Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together. And of course, we are talking with Sydney Mahone about Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis ahead of the screening at the University of Wisconsin Parkside of the film Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee. You're in a very good position to help us better understand the magnitude of their accomplishments. And I wonder if we could begin with the artistic facet. Remind our listeners about the wide-ranging talents which they both possessed and utilized to such an impressive degree, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis.
that's a massive task.
Sorry about that.
But I will attempt an answer. The artistic contributions are hard to quantify because you could look at their, you know, the list of films that they were in or the number of plays that they performed in and count the plays that they wrote or the books, the poems, and that number would be significant. But there was another impact that came from their very presence in the field that encouraged them to see to it that other people also had more opportunities to work in Hollywood, not only as actors and performers, but people behind the scenes. So they really were advocates for breaking down the discrimination that they saw for the technicians and the directors and the designers. But there's a quality to those, to their performances that I just want to speak on. The thing that was so profound and compelling about Ruby Dee's performances and Ossie's performances was this sense that they infused, filled up those characters, however small they might be, and sometimes they were not small, but filled those characters with a genuine sense of love for Black culture. And this sense of loving Black people infused their work. And then there was always an element of surprise. There was something, that a certain kind of spontaneity that would just shock the imagination, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, they're representing someone that I know. They often played somewhat ordinary or lesser-known characters. If you think of A Raisin in the Sun, these were not, you know, biopics on celebrities. These were everyday people who were struggling to survive and to thrive. And yet they performed them in ways that showed their heroic dimensions. And so perhaps that's the way of saying it. They were able to dramatize the heroic dimensions of everyday Black life in a way that rendered it beautiful and transformative.
Mm.
If you can recognize your beauty in someone else, that somehow liberates your sense of self and allows you to see yourself in a new way.
Mm. What would you say it was about them that allowed their work as activists to be so exceptionally effective? What would you say were their particular qualities that that lent, in a sense, such strength to their work in that particular area?
Very early on, they recognized that their celebrity and their access as actors gave them a certain platform that most other people didn't have. And they would find ways to bring literature and art, say, to union workers, or they would go to places that, you know, may not necessarily be on the map to support an event or a movement for change. It's like they went everywhere, it seems. I don't think there is a Black theater in the last 30, 40 years that had not had the benefit of Ruby and Ossie doing a benefit for them. Even when they, when this book was published, they had a book party in New York, and all the benefits went to 10 black theaters that they had selected. So there was a consciousness of their ability to affect the lives of people who were struggling at a different level or at lower levels, and but were reaching for a kind of empowerment. And I think it's what they witnessed growing up in Ruby's early years in Harlem. There was always a brand of activism that took to the streets. You know, there was no fear of protesting, say, the stores on 7th Avenue in Harlem if they were not hiring black workers. Well, then there would be a boycott of that store. I mean, it was just a part of the community that she grew up in. And I think the role of the actor is one that allows you to be kind of a chameleon. You can adapt your skills to any given situations. But because you have the microphone, you are able to draw the attention of the masses. I feel there's some of it that came from their communities, but there was also something in each of them that just recognized the power of the word, of art, to change a person's mind, change their perspective. And they didn't hesitate to deploy their own skills to that end. I think they also were in touch with the people who were at the forefront of the larger movements, Dr. King and Malcolm X and others, and they had to find their role in that process.
And of course, the two of them also had a personal connection as husband and wife, a loving husband and wife for many, many decades, I think for over a half century, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And that had to be something that you also came to deeply appreciate as you worked with them on this project.
It was phenomenal to witness. So much of it came through their love of laughter. They made each other laugh so much, and it was a kind of wit that was contagious, along with their fierce intelligence was this very sharp wit, and also an ease of laughter. I think there was a joke that Ossie would tell. He said, well, he would say to Ruby, if you ever decide to leave me, I'm coming with you. You know? So just be ready because I'm coming with you. But I think I can't say that I have full understanding of the keys to that. But there was deep mutual respect and devotion to each other as artists and as individuals. I think when they took on their writing lives in earnest, that propelled them into yet another dimension of love. But their commitment to passing that on to the family, to their children, I think was very important to them as well. And that reminds me of my mother and father, Mary Lou and Arthur, and how important it was for them to sustain the family with sheer love, unconditional love.
Wonderfully said, and I think evoking your mother and father, that really helps us also put the extraordinary lives of Ruby Davis and Ruby D and Ossie Davis into proper perspective. Again, we remind people that